suggested Al-Anon family groups. She said there are no dues or fees. At first, I was afraid to go to Al-Anon. I felt like a fool to care about somebody who can't stop drinking. But Al-Anon members know exactly how I feel. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Hi, this is Kevin Bright and the Upper York Mandolin Orchestra, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 in Guelph.
The Guelph Wellington Health.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
This being a reading of the last statement of James Connolly, I quote, "To the Field General Court Martial held at Dublin Castle, May 9, 1916. We went out to break the connection between this country and the British Empire and to establish an Irish Republic. We believe the call we then issued to the people of Ireland was a nobler call and a holier cause than any call issued to them during that World War or having any connection with the war. We succeeded in proving that Irish men are ready to die, endeavouring to win for Ireland those national rights which the British government has been asking them to die to win for Belgium. As long as that remains the case, the cause of Irish freedom is safe. Believing that the British government has no right in Ireland, never had any right in Ireland, and never can have any right in Ireland. The presence in any one generation of even a respectable minority willing to die to affirm that truth makes that government forever a usurpation and a crime against human progress. I personally thank God that I have lived to see the day when thousands of Irish men and boys and hundreds of Irish women and girls were ready to affirm and to attest to that truth with their lives if need be. Signed this day, 9 May, 1916. James Connolly, Cumberland General, Dublin Division, Army of the Irish Republic, IRA.
Marching down Sackville Street, starry plowing high. Here comes the citizen army, to the sky. Leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name is James Connolly. I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. The chant goes up, all citizens, this system is a curse. An English boss is a bastard, an Irish one even worse. They'll never lock us out again, and here's the reason why. My name is James Connolly. I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. by. Up steps our citizen leader, and he rose up to the sky. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, the small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. They shot him in Kilmainham jail, but they'll never stop his cry. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, the small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. I want to apologize just for the last few weeks. I had a few pre-recorded sessions on. Well, actually, not even pre-recorded. They were actually from last year, largely because I've been so busy. I haven't actually been around and been able to do a live show. But we are here. I'm going to be talking to Brendan Campisi on the show here tonight because we are going to talk about the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rebellion. And I know I've done a lot of shows dealing with Irish history and the history of the Irish liberation struggle, anti-colonial struggle. And you might be asking me at this point, you know, what more is there to tell? You know, you've dealt with this like so many times. But the history of struggle is eternal. It's difficult to describe what it is like to be buried. Your people, your culture, your language, your way of life, your reason for being, driven underground. In the silence of unmarked graves in desolate places, while the world above ground marches to the beat of stereotypes, propaganda, lies, sanitized narratives, and deliberately forgotten memories. They try to erase you. Make it seem like you were never born, a worthless human being in life and trampled into the dirt in death. But all their efforts are in vain, so long as human hearts beat and human spirits continue to strive for liberation. The fire of our souls will never dim. Whether it is the souls of the Warsaw Ghetto, the souls of the Black Panthers, the souls of Palestine, or the souls of those brave men and women we will be discussing here tonight, who gave their lives to the liberation of Ireland and stood against 800 years of colonial rule and genocidal repression. These are my people. And we're still here. Mm-hmm.
something one Easter morn to a city far away. There are armed lines of marching men in squadrons passed me by. No pipe did hum, no battle drum did sound its dread tattoo, but the angelus bell o'er the Liffey's well rang out in the foggy dew. Right proudly high over Dublin town they hoisted a flag of war. It was better to die 'neath an Irish sky than at Suthal or Tudabar. And from plains of royal mead strong men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with their long range guns sailed in through the foggy dew. It was England but our wild geese go, that's one nation to might be free. But their lonely graves are by Suthal's waves on the fringe of the great North Sea. Oh, had they died at Pearson's side, or fought with Calbrook, their names we would keep where Fenians live in the shroud of foggy dew. Oh, the night fell black and the rifles crack made perfidious Albion reel. Bits bled and rained, 7 tongues of flame shone out old lines of steel. By each shining blade a prayer was said that to Ireland her sons be true. And when morning broke, still the war flag shook its folds in the foggy dew. Oh, the bravest fell and the requiem bell rang and clear. For those who died at Easter tide in the springtime of the year, and the world did gaze in deep amaze at those fearless men. And as back down the glen I rode again, my heart with grief was sore, as I thought on the lines of valiant men I never will see more. And to and fro in my dreams I go. I kneel and pray for you. For slavery fled or glorious death, when you fell in the foggy town.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was one of the many, many, many versions of that particular song, The Foggy Dew, about the 1916 Easter Rising. That particular one is very special. It means a lot to me personally. And it was actually done by prisoners of war, you know, IRA prisoners of war, in British jail in Northern Ireland in the 1990s. You know, and they made that recording of The Foggy Dew. Because really, they're very conscious of this, you know, like people who were, you know, at any stage of the liberation struggle in Ireland, they were very conscious of the tradition of resistance that they were engaged in, like going back centuries of fighting against colonialism. And, you know, so that's one of the reasons I wanted to play that particular, you know, version of the song, because it's almost coming right from... You know, it's coming from direct experience. It's coming from, like, people who have actually participated in the struggle. You know, there's other versions of that song. I mean, you know, there's, like, Damien Dempsey does a really good version of it. You know, Christy Moore does a version of it. There's a whole ton of singers who do versions of that song. But like I said, that's prisoners of war, you know, doing, in a British jail, doing that song, that version of the song. So you're not going to get closer than that, really. So, but anyway, I am here with Brendan Campisi, who I've had on the show quite a number of times. We've talked about a numerous subjects.
Hello again.
You know, yeah, like whether we've talked about the Korean War, we've talked about human rights in the Soviet Union, whether we've talked about, like, you know, many, many things. And I find, like, our discussions are always quite illuminating, well, for me, and hopefully for you who are listening. So now we have him here. We're going to talk about the Easter Rising. We're going to talk about the Irish tradition of resistance against British rule. So once again, welcome to the show, Brendan.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
All right. So I think we probably should start with kind of giving the context of the Easter Rising, like how it emerged. And I guess to do that, we kind of have to go back, you know, several centuries at least of of Irish resistance against colonial rule. And going back through really the different stages of colonialism in Ireland and the different methods of control which the British colonial authorities tried to exert over Irish people. Because, of course, to give a few examples, of course, in the Middle Ages, the main tactic was, of course, to win over the Irish aristocracy, you know, to the British crown, basically co-opt them. The strategy shifted, of course, after the Protestant Reformation. You know, then it becomes increasingly a religious crusade almost. We will expel the Papists from Ireland. We will bring in settlers. And increasingly, that evolves into a racial dynamic in Ireland where, of course, basically the Irish people basically are criminalized and are consigned to a subhuman status. And that lasts until the middle of the 19th century, where then you have, like, once again, we change tactics. And you have the, you know, people who are Roman Catholics, people who are Irish being co-opted into the elite once again. And that becomes, like, another tactic leading up to 1916. So going through that process... Like, where would you really trace, you could say, the beginnings of the movement that emerged in 1916? Would you trace it, like, from, say, the Irish Republican movement in the 1790s? Would you go back further?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting discussion there. Because you could talk about sort of objective and subjective sort of national struggle, right? And we can point to the existence of colonialism in Ireland, at least going back to, you know, to the 12th, 13th century, and then sort of the consolidation of English or British colonial rule across the entire island in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. And you can see that, you know, there's an obvious relationship of national oppression there, and there's resistance. You know, for the first several hundred years, resistance under the leadership of the traditional Irish landowning class and the Irish, you know, ruling class such as it existed. And then there was a period of sort of where that tradition was submerged for most of the 18th century during the period of sort of the harshest enforcement of this this racialized oppression, where Irish Catholic people had absolutely no rights whatsoever. They could hardly pass on property. They couldn't vote. They couldn't own weapons. They couldn't serve in the army. They couldn't go to university, etc. And then you have where I would mark the beginning of sort of the self-conscious subjective Irish national liberation struggle from the end of the 18th century with the organization of the United Irishmen and the uprising in 1798. So it depends whether, you know, whether you want to say, you know, we date this from the real existence of Irish people fighting, you know, foreign rule, or the self-conscious struggle by people who think of themselves as Irish nationalists fighting for an independent Irish nation. Because, of course, the Irish Republican movement does not emerge until the existence of modern nationalism as an ideology in the aftermath of the French Revolution. But it does very immediately after, within a decade of the sort of the modern idea of the democratic national state coming together, you have people advocating that in Ireland. And I think that in a way shows that the sort of proto-national consciousness was already quite strong, because it didn't take very long once this idea entered into the culture for significant numbers of people in Ireland to take it up, which to me indicates that it resonated with, you know, an aspect of their actual, you know, material situation and how they experienced that and how they already understood it, in that, you know, they were able to recognize very clearly that they were a subjugated nation. So, yeah, I guess it depends which aspect of that you want to consider to be more important.
Well, of course, the level of repression after the 1798 rebellion was very, very intense. You know, that's where you get, like, the penal colonies in Australia.
Right.
That's where you get, like, I mean, really, it leads up to the genocide, you could say, that, you know, is passed off as, like, the Irish potato famine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reason why my family ultimately came here to begin with. In the 1840s, you know, and obviously that's a very, very painful chapter in Irish history. It's almost the final breaking down of the Irish culture and society as it existed in the past. I mean, it'd already been under siege for multiple centuries, but that was almost like the final blow.
Right. And that's very clear, especially with the language.
Right.
There are debates about this, but the weight of the evidence is that at least the larger part of the island, at least the western half of Ireland, was mostly Irish-speaking until the famine. And then after the famine, for the masses of people across the island, the Irish language was now irrevocably associated with backwardness and poverty and misery, and the idea really took hold in the Irish consciousness that this language was not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
And of course you have mass emigration of Irish people, mostly to the English-speaking settler societies, mostly to Canada, the United States, Australia, where although a significant number of those immigrants did speak the Irish language, there was no place for it in the new countries that where they'd gone to. And so within a very short period of time, the Irish language more or less disappears from these diasporic communities. But then even in Ireland itself, the decline of a language just accelerates through the later part of the 19th century. Although, within a few decades of the famine, you do have cultural nationalism starting to emerge, and you do have a linguistic revival movement that's part of a wider sort of cultural revival movement. People talk about, you know, trying to revive the traditional Irish sports, Irish forms of literature, and what have you. But these are, of course, the pursuits of members of the intelligentsia, mostly.
Right.
Yeah. As far as the, you know, the working and farming masses of the Irish people, we can say in the second half of the 19th century, tragically, the indigenous language was abandoned, and it has never really been revived. There are very few people today who live their lives in an unselfconscious way in the Irish language. You can only really do that in scattered communities in the rural west of the island. Mm-hmm. And we can get into a bit later sort of what the deeper causes of why the supposedly independent Irish state has not been able to like substantially revive the national
the language
culture. Although obviously the Irish national culture can be expressed in English, and many of the great expressions of Irish culture and of literary culture in the English language have been the products of Irish writers. Mm-hmm. But obviously the indigenous language is a crucial element of that. So definitely it's right to point to the famine as a crucial moment in that cultural destruction, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I actually want to read a quote from the Invention of the White Race by Theodore W. Allen. Well, actually, one of the things which he does mention is like what happened to the diaspora communities, mm-hmm. especially in the settler states, and how ultimately the Irish became white, effectively. You know, it became co-opted into this this idea. You know, this racial, basically the system of racial apartheid in North America, and almost, you know, co-opted into serving slave-owning interests in the case of, like, Irish people living in New York City. But one of the things it also talks about is the creation of kind of a comprador class in Ireland. Mm-hmm. You know, like this class which is going to assist in the ruling of the country and basically do the British government's bidding in Ireland. And these people are Irish Catholics, you know, who are forming this. And one of the leaders of this, this is basically the quote: "It was the proud boast of O'Connell and his English Whig colleagues that the social control services of the Catholic bourgeoisie had enabled the government to supply from its Irish garrisons one force to put down the English workers fighting for the right to vote and another to fight against the French Catholic and English rebels in Canada in 1837. Right? So, I mean, talking basically about how this comprador class is imposing control on Ireland, that frees up troops that the British Army can send to other places, including to England itself, to suppress rebellions going on there. And you know, that this is a good thing. There are actually Irish people who thought that was a good thing, you know, who were in the right. Elite. You know. And so I'm assuming, like, leading up to 1916, that was still a thing. Like, there were still, you know, there was still, like, a comprador class existing in Ireland.
Absolutely. That, mm-hmm. And you can see that sort of playing out in a number of distinct political forces. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, a unionist section of the Irish right. elite. But more or less down to the period following 1916, what's known in the historiography as the Irish Revolutionary Period,
right.
the Irish elite of whatever specific religious or cultural affiliation was more or less divided between unionists and the politics of home rule, which yeah. was nationalist in a sense, but advocated autonomy for Ireland rather than independence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were some genuinely heroic figures, the Parnells and others, who were involved in the home rule movement because it was the dominant expression of the Irish national struggle, of the objectively existing Irish national struggle for a period of several decades. But ultimately, it did contain that struggle mm-hmm. to an extent, sort of containing it within, within the British parliamentary system. There was a disavowal of militant struggle.
Right.
And for several decades, there was, other than the land war, the class war in the countryside, was the main expression of militant struggle in Ireland during the decades of a later 19th century. The militant aspect of a national struggle was successfully contained more or less after 1867, except in the form of Fenian actions in North America.
Right.
There were, of course, a number of armed actions in Canada in the 1860s. There was an armed rebellion in Ireland in 1867, and there were a series of armed actions in Britain in the 1880s. But beyond that, the sort of the armed struggle, physical force republicanism, as it's called, was more or less contained for a period of several decades, mm-hmm. leading up to the 1910s when the contradictions began to sharpen significantly, and that leads us into the immediate, mm-hmm. the immediate foreshadowing of 1916.
Okay, well, so before we get into 1916, I want to play a song. I'm going to dedicate this to our friend and comrade, Mr. Patrick O'Brien, because I always associate this song with him. This song's called Highland Paddy, and it's basically a song about the Fenian struggle in the 19th century and the kind of period, you could say, of guerrilla resistance, mm-hmm. sporadic guerrilla resistance in Ireland, and some of the courageous fighters who were involved in that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
One even fair as the sun was shining, to Kilkenny I did ride. I did meet with Captain Brady, a tall commander by his side. And you are welcome, Highland Paddy. By my side you'll surely stand, hear the people shout for freedom. We'll rise in the morning with the morning with the Fenian band. In the morning we rose early, just before the break of dawn. Blackbirds singing in the bushes, greetings to a smiling morn. Gather round me, men of Ireland, gather Fenians, gather round, hand to hand with sword and musket, spill the blood on this holy ground. And you are welcome, Highland Paddy. By my side you surely stand, hear the people shout for freedom. We'll rise in the morning with the Fenian band, rise in the morning with the Fenian band.
There's a glen beside the river, just outside your penny town. There's a grave beside the river, a mile outside Kilkenny town. There we lay down all the captain, birds were silent when the Fenian died. All my life I will remember, I'll remember night and day, that once I rode into Kilkenny and I heard this noble captain say, then you are welcome, Highland Paddy. By my side you surely stand, hear the people shout for freedom. We'll rise in the morning with the Fenian band, rise in the morning with the Fenian band. Then you are welcome, Highland Paddy. By my side you surely stand, hear the people shout for freedom. We'll rise in the morning with the Fenian band, rise in the morning with the Fenian band. Then you are welcome, Highland Paddy.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. This is Wolf Tone. That was Wolf Tones with Highland Paddy. Once again, dedicating that to Patrick O'Brien, who
hi Patrick.
You know, Patrick, yeah, who's an amazing guy. Who actually, you know, did the show while I was in China. So that's something I am going to be. I mean, like, I'm eternally grateful. I'm going to say that now. I'm eternally grateful to Patrick for doing that. That was a very, very noble commitment on his part. And, you know, and I really do appreciate that. So there we go. That's a song for him. And that's also a song for the Fenians in the 19th century resisting British rule in Ireland. Well, by extension, the land war, which, of course, brought the really mobilized the Irish peasantry.
Right.
You know, against British rule, and produced mass meetings. I mean, you had, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people meeting at any given time. Like in I know the example in Cork, you know, in County Cork, where which my own family would have most definitely participated in. You know, there was like 500,000 people.
Right.
You know, it was like the vast majority of the entire population like went to one of these land meetings that were basically against, you know, that were resisting. British control of the land, British landlords, and the exploitation of the peasantry. So that was a very, very major thing. But I guess we should probably get into more around 1916, I should say. You know, we're of course, like, leading up to that. But the actual situation in 1916, of course, like, you know, Britain had been in a war for at least for 2 years. But almost 2 years by that point. And already you had had, you know, thousands upon thousands. I would say the death toll at least would have been in the hundreds of thousands of in terms of Irishmen at that point.
Oh,
you know,
for sure.
The Irishmen who had been drawn into that conflict, basically fighting Britain's war. And were losing their lives in, you know, in Flanders, at Gallipoli, in all these kind of engagements, like far away from Ireland. You know, fighting and dying for the British Empire. You know, their own people basically were still colonized, you know. So, I mean, their experience almost parallels, to some extent, the experience of certain, you know, African colonial troops, you know, being sent in to, you know, by the French, by the British, and dying for their colonial masters on the battlefields of Europe. You know, you have these colonized people who are doing that. And that really has to be taken into account when we understand what's going on in 1916. And the rising of the Citizens' Army and the march and the occupation of the GPO in downtown Dublin and the resulting massive crackdown by the British forces, you know, over a period of days. But, I mean, the resistance was really quite heroic. I mean, they managed to fend off, I think, several British divisions for the better part of a week, I think, you know. And, I mean, I'm not, you know, too much of an expert on the details of that that particular struggle, but it was... You know, it's justly memorialized in song and in story and the various heroes, the people who participated in the various, you know, people like James Connolly and Patrick Pearse and these people, like, are very central to the, you know, they're right up there with people like Wolfe Tone, who led the rebellion in 1798 in terms of their importance to the liberation struggle and their kind of the symbolic value that they have. So I guess more what we probably should talk about is like the, kind of the makeup of the movement.
Right.
That that participate in the Easter Rising, like the
yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting question, and it's important, and I'm glad you brought up the issue of the war, because that is sort of what precipitates the, you know, the crisis where this, you know, this action is able to take place. And basically, what you have to look at is over the previous few years, politics in Ireland had radicalized dramatically.
Oh, yeah.
The dominance of home rule nationalism was coming to an end, or rather, the contradictions of home rule nationalism were coming to the fore, because in the years leading up to the First World War, the British Parliament showed increasing willingness to pass a home rule bill. And what that precipitated was a unionist reaction. And unionist forces in Ireland began arming themselves. They began organizing paramilitary bodies. And it became clear that the British army would not fight them. And there were conservatives in Britain who talked about a civil war if the government decided to give up Ireland. We can see this as being similar to the political dynamics that developed in France in the 1950s, where you had, you know, far-right terrorists trying to assassinate De Gaulle for selling out
like
Algeria.
Algeria,
as an example. So home rule nationalism had created a situation of escalating contradictions and militarization, because in response to the organizing of armed groups by the Unionists, the Nationalist movement also organized armed groups. You have the formation of the Irish Volunteers in, I believe, 1913. Mm-hmm. And the political forces that dominated the Irish Volunteers were not radical Republicans. There were radical Republicans in the movement. Members of the Irish Republican Brotherhood engaged in a kind of entryism in the Irish Volunteers, where they sort of hid their politics for a while to be able to gain organizational positions within the Irish Volunteers, because the dominant political forces in the Irish Volunteers were home rulers. And they wanted to win, you know, national autonomy for Ireland within the system, but they recognized that there was a strong possibility of armed Unionist resistance, and they wanted to prepare for that. And then the Irish Volunteers split over the war because the sort of the loyal opposition followed the British war effort. Hmm. And a significant portion of the Irish Volunteers did, in fact, volunteer to fight for Britain. There was no conscription in Ireland up to these years. I don't remember off the top of my head when conscription was introduced in Britain, but it didn't end up being introduced in Ireland until 1918. So
I think it was 1916 in Britain.
So during the first couple of years of the war, you have Irish people volunteering to go fight. But of course, as everywhere involved in the First World War, as it ground on and more people are lost in the meat grinder of trench warfare, people become increasingly disillusioned. And in a context where you have growing class tensions, both in Britain and in Ireland, of course, there was a very, very militant, one of the most militant class struggles in Irish history before the war, the Dublin Lockout, a growing contradiction around the national question, the consequences of the war were obviously pretty dramatic. And so you have the radical leadership of the Republican movement understanding that they have an opportunity, that they can use the crisis engendered by the war to sort of detonate the contradictions that had been building in Irish society and that were so obvious by 1914. And so that's why, even though there was a division even within the portion of the Irish Volunteers that remained in one organization, and there were many areas of the country where the leadership of the Irish Volunteers refused to go along with the rising, and there were many more people who could have been involved than were, but ultimately, despite these internal divisions, the radical leadership, Pierce and Connolly, and the sort of the group around them, were able to seize this opportunity, and then they took this action. And it, in some ways, it proved them right in the long term, that there was a popular base for militant national struggle in Ireland, even if 1916 itself was not a mass struggle. And I think the best explanation of that, of the significance of 1916 in those terms, actually comes from the reflections that Lenin did on it. So I might get into that in a minute, unless there was something that you wanted to add.
No, I think that's a pretty good segue, actually, in terms of like understanding Ireland in terms of the national question, you know, understanding it in terms of anti-colonial resistance.
Sure.
And in the way that certainly Lenin understood anti-imperialism.
Right. So Lenin wrote on the Easter Rising in the polemic that was going on in the International Socialist Movement, and specifically that wing of the International Socialist Movement that had broken with the Second International over the first, or yes, the Second International over the First World War, and he wrote about the Irish Rising in the context of the debate over national self-determination, because there was of course a very heated debate, with the main poles being the Bolsheviks and then the Social Democrats in Poland, who opposed the principle of national self-determination and who did not defend it, did not uphold it, and the Russian Bolsheviks who upheld it quite strongly. Although not all the Russian Bolsheviks. There were forces in and around the Bolshevik Party like Trotsky who rejected national self-determination at this point. But 1916, the Easter Rising, was for Lenin an example of the fact that anti-imperialist struggle can come from anywhere, more or less. And then he said it would be a folly to dismiss it on the grounds that the people who led it were not the working class. And that's true. the most of the people who led the Republican movement in 1916 were school teachers, bank clerks, and the like. They were mostly petty bourgeois and intellectual people. But Lenin made the point that to expect social revolution to come without national uprisings in the oppressed nations and without the involvement of a wide range of forces besides the proletariat would be to renounce the idea of revolution. Because the world is not so simple, he pointed out, that a revolution is where one army lines up on one side and says, we are for imperialism, and another lines up and says, we are for socialism. And that anyone in what I think is really an immortal phrase, anyone who expects a pure social revolution will never live to see it. So Lenin was able to recognize that despite the fact that there was, you know, not explicit, you know, an explicit revolutionary socialist program, or the fact that it did not involve the vast masses, or the fact that, you know, the dominant the people involved in it were, to a large extent, you know, middle class people, that it was a revolutionary blow struck at British imperialism. And he denounced those who considered it a putsch. And he defined a putsch as an action that reveals only a small group of conspirators with no support among the people.
Right.
And demonstrably, 1916 did not reveal that. 1916, in fact, revealed a large reservoir of popular support for the armed struggle. And over the next few years, the execution of the leaders of the rising, the imposition of the imposition of conscription in Ireland made manifest that support. And in 1916, the Irish people overwhelmingly voted for a nationalist and independentist assembly. They voted independentist representatives who then made their choice not to take their seats in the British Parliament and formed the First Dáil and declared the independence of Ireland. And that support was made manifest again in the next 2 years as the Irish people organized in the, you know, the First IRA fought a war of liberation against the British. So even if 1916 was not the mass armed liberation struggle, it was neither was it a premature adventure, because by engaging in this action, they were able to sharpen the contradictions and the consequences that followed on from it, sharpen the contradictions to the point where that became possible. And this is what Lenin was able to understand. And this is what, in fact, many people in the Republican movement were able to understand. A radical Republican named Liam Mellows, in the course of the debate over the Anglo-Irish Treaty after the War of Independence, said that, well, 1916 did not represent the will of the people. 1916 had very little support from the people. But it has been ratified by the people since, in the form of the election, in the form of the war. So I think it's very useful to look at it as a way of sort of defining what is and is not a truly adventurist action, in the same sense that, for example, the Moncada Barracks attack, while it was unsuccessful and it was suppressed, it did not reveal a group of conspirators with no support from the people. In fact, it revealed that the masses of the Cuban people hated Batista. And within a few years, the same thing had taken place. Within a few years, the dynamic that this small group of revolutionaries had sought to release by their action was, in fact, consummated in the Revolutionary War.
Okay. So I think on that note, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually play a song from the Irish Civil War, like in the Irish liberation struggle against the British in the early 1920s. And this is called The Boys of Kilmichael, sung by Declan Hunt. And so I'm going to lead into that. And this is, of course, an instance where a group of the members of the IRA ambushed and destroyed a column of the Black and Tans, who, of course, were the British paramilitary forces in the South. So so please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
While we honor in song and in story the memory of Pearson McRae, whose names are loomed who long have since died. Forget not the boys of Kilmichael, who feared not the might of the foe. The day that
they marched into battle, they laid all the blackened towns low. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads so gallant and true. They fought me the green flag of Erin and conquered the red, white and blue. On the 28th day of November, the towns left the town of Macroom. They were seated in two costly tenders that was bringing them straight to their doom. They were all on the road to Kilmichael and never expecting to stop. They there met the boys from the column who made a clean sweep of the lot. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads so gallant and true. They fought neath the green flag of Erin and conquered the red, white and blue. The sun in the west, it was sinking, 'twas the eve of a cold winter's day. When the towns we were eagerly waiting sailed into the spot where we lay. And over the hill came the echo, the peal of the rifle and gun. And the flames from the lorries brought tidings that the boys of Kilmichael had won. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads who can.
CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
This is James Valvano, founder and president of WeHaveAFace.org, Inc. We advocate internationally for Huntington's disease and juvenile Huntington's disease, a genetic, hereditary, and terminal degenerative brain disease. It affects women, men, and children across the globe. It is like having Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, and schizophrenia, all at the same time. On April 23rd, WeHaveAFace.org will be showing our international film, The Huntington's Disease Project, Removing the Mask. It will take place at the University of Guelph in Alexander Hall. Doors will be open at 12:30 p.m., and the viewing of the documentary starts at 2:30 p.m. In cooperation with the Huntington Society of Canada, WeHaveAFace.org looks forward to this educational and free event. Please visit WeHaveAFace.org/Canada.
Alexander Hall is a physically accessible location.
Close to Home. An eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM, Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll even play that different Canadian song that you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
In retirement, I thought my husband and I would enjoy going places together. Our son's drinking interfered with our plans. We worried about him and our grandchildren and didn't know where to go for help. We found help and support at Al-Anon family group meetings in hospitals, churches, and schools. Is someone's drinking troubling you? You might be surprised at what you can learn at an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
It's like, okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So we just had a slight break with the PSAs. And before that, we had Declan Hunt with The Boys of Kilmichael, which is a song from the Irish liberation struggle in the early 1920s. So we're still here with Brendan Campisi. And so I guess going forward from this, so we've talked about 1916, we've talked about the Easter Rising. And so now we basically are in the period where the Irish Free State is established, where Ireland is partitioned. You know, so this is where like Northern Ireland comes into being. And the you know, the sectarian situation in Northern Ireland, that really comes into really takes center stage, you know, in the Irish liberation struggle. So basically, how does this evolve, like in terms of the movement for liberation in Ireland, national liberation?
Right. Well, there are a few sort of important developments, but first, I think I'd like to just step back a little bit,
okay,
and talk about the beginnings of a self-conscious Republican socialist tradition. And that more or less originates in the later part of the 19th century. And the leading figure is somebody who we heard from, well, we heard the words of.
Right.
At the beginning of the show. And that's James Connolly, who was, of course, born in Scotland to Irish immigrant parents in desperate poverty, as most Irish immigrants in Britain at that point lived in. And who served in the British Army in Ireland and became disgusted with, you know, being part of an army of occupation, keeping his own people down, and who participated in the labor movement in the United States for many years and became a socialist and then returned to Ireland and was engaged in socialist and nationalist politics. And in 1897, he wrote a piece on called Socialism and Nationalism, in which he said that if the green flag were to be hoisted over Dublin Castle tomorrow and nothing else, England would still rule Ireland through the banks and ownership of the industries and through control of the Irish economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a sense, is a very pioneering analysis of neocolonialism. And Connolly, of course, goes on to play the leading role in the organization of the Irish Citizens Army, which was a working-class armed self-defense group that emerged out of the labor struggles in Dublin in around 1913. And the Citizen Army then goes on, of course, to play a role in 1916, and Connolly ends up being executed. But he is then vindicated in the following years because substantially what happens in the Irish Free State is what he predicted would happen if Irish independence came without socialism. And you have the formation of a neo-colonial state ruled by the same class forces who had dominated Ireland under direct British rule. And you have the symbols of this, of course, are the fact that Ireland is still part of the British Empire, the fact that the British monarch is still the sovereign, the fact that there are British naval bases. But even after all of those things are eliminated by the 1940s, and you have the formation of, in name, the Irish Republic, not only do you still have partition and direct British rule in the north, you still have substantial British economic and cultural domination of the southern state. This is why the southern state has never been able to revive the Irish language and the Irish national culture, because it is still culturally enthralled to Britain. And in recent, you know, in recent decades, there's been increasing influence in Ireland from the United States,
mm-hmm,
and from the European Union. But in any case, there has not been independence. There's been very little independent economic development. Ireland's economic boom in the 1990s was built on U.S. investment. It was in many ways a subsidiary to the economic boom, the very fragile economic boom in the United States, which is why the Irish economic boom was doubly fragile. So we can see that Connolly was extremely insightful in predicting the dynamics of what would happen with the sort of partial independence,
mm-hmm,
of the island without, or, well, a portion of the island without socialism. So that's sort of the beginning of the Republican socialist tradition. And then you have, you know, the years of the 1920s are very, very difficult for the Republican movement. There's another split in 1926, and the majority of the forces who resisted the the treaty split off, or at least a significant portion of them split off and make their peace with the Free State, become Fianna Fáil under the leadership of Éamon de Valera. And then the different